Blog Talk Radio. Good afternoon, everyone. This is May Pang speaking to you live. We're actually live from New York. And Cynthia, you're down there in Nashville, and it's a very cold day.
Yeah, it's cold here, too, but it's sunny. So at least the gloom has kind of the gloomy day went away, but we woke up to some unfortunate news, didn't we all?
I am just devastated because, and you know, I heard about it at around 2:30 in the morning. And, you know, it's David Bowie. I can't believe he's gone. And, you know, he was someone I knew very well from way back when John and I met him. And it's funny because people say, oh, well, did I meet David through John? It's funny because John and I met him at the same time. And it was actually through Elizabeth Taylor. So
which
was,
is wild.
Which is wild in itself, you know. He was a lovely man. We got to know him better later on when he called us when we were in New York. And I was there when they wrote Fame and how it all happened. And it's just I just can't believe. David invited me to see his opening night when he was doing the Elephant Man. And it's all these little things that I'm in his video, one of his videos, Fashion. So you have these memories, and he was there when I, you know, he was comforting me when John died, and you know, so it's, but I really, it's just crazy. I just can't believe he's not here.
It was certainly a very carefully guarded secret, and he always controlled his life. He did things the way he wanted to do them, and certainly this happened the way he wanted it too. Here's his stats: 26 albums, 111 singles, 51 music videos, 51 years of making music and art. Wow.
I know. And, you know, I think this last one, Black Star, would have been his 27th. I'm not sure. But I'll tell you what else. I mean, he even controlled it to the point that his last video was from Lazarus, you know, from for Black Star. You know, he did that video. And he did it just recently. And, you know, and it was kind of eerie. I watched it. So... anyway,
well, and of course, too, your ex-husband Tony Visconti produced that, didn't he? His last,
yeah, he did.
Yeah,
it was his last thing. And apparently, somebody else wrote to me just recently that I saw that they were at a show where where Tony was performing with a couple of members from an old Bowie band, and he called on the phone. I think he was talking to David, and he got the audience to sing Happy Birthday to him. So,
wow. Well, yeah. Certainly, from the reaction all over the social media and all over the news, he probably was not even totally aware of the impact. Whoops. Okay, that might have been the cat. He did not, he probably wasn't even aware of the impact that he made on music, on art, and it certainly will echo into the future. And it was a shocking loss, but he did it his way, and he will be missed. He will
absolutely
be missed.
Yes. Condolences
on the other
to the
hand,
family.
Let's talk for a moment about the Golden Globes, shall we?
Oh my God! The
what
Golden
a debacle!
Globes.
May, it's, and we have a guest today, so I'm not gonna hammer on this too long. I'm not dragging the soapbox off, but all I'm gonna say is, it used to be circus sideshows were at bad carnivals and low life, low down, run down circuses. The entertainment business now is a circus sideshow, and Ricky Gervais used to be funny. I just can't remember the last time he was. And let me tell you something about these women who are rolling their eyes and acting like they don't think it's cool to be there, and they're annoyed, or they're lecturing people on their cell phone. There isn't one of you in that audience as an actor, as a director, as a producer, as a performer that didn't dream about the moment that you'd be up on that stage winning an award or even relevant enough to be presenting one. So stop. Stop. Stop posing. Ugh, we just become a bunch of posers, and I'm posing now. But it was bad. Bad. I don't know.
I know. I know. It's true.
And the marketing was a comedy? I know it's the foreign press, and maybe they don't get our American sense of humor, but The Martian was not a comedy.
Did you
comedy
see it?
Comedy of errors? I don't know. Yeah, a comedy. It won for comedy or musical.
I know, but I was going to say, did you see it?
Yeah, I saw it. It was too long, boring, and not really very impressive. I'm sorry. So
yeah.
Although I would like to go to Mars. So if they are getting that journey, that group together, I would go on the list. I'd get on the list. I would. Could you picture being stuck with me
I think
for 20 years on a spaceship?
Maybe you better talk to Richard Branson.
Richard Branson.
Yeah.
Yeah. Anyway, let's get to our guest today, because you know there's a term Renaissance man, all right, and it's bandied about by people, and when you really look at the reality of what they're describing, it doesn't fit the bill. But this guy fits the bill. There isn't anybody who does not remember The Love and Spoonful. Anybody. Do you believe in magic? Yeah. You still hear that song. You hear it all over the place.
Oh, are you kidding? I mean, I think the songs at The Loving Spoonful, it's all classic. I mean, when you hear it, hot, you know, what was it? When you hear all these other songs, that I mean, for me, you know, Do You Believe in Magic was the start of it. I mean, I just hear that, and I just go into another world. Well, you know.
Well, yeah, I mean, so much so that they were actually inducted into the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame in 2000. But this particular member, one of the original members, their bass player, Steve Moon, he isn't just a musician. This guy went out on his boat, May, I think for 4 years, and just stayed on a boat. Which I think is like a fantastic thing to talk about, you know. And without further ado, we want to welcome to the show bass player for The Love and Spoonful and Renaissance man, Steve Boone.
Well, thank you, Cynthia and May. It's very nice to be here. And I appreciate being called a Renaissance man, and that assumes that I woke up after 20 years of sleeping, though. But But actually, you know, I have had a terrific life. And before I go into my life, I just have to agree with both of you that, you know, David's passing, he was truly a Renaissance man in the classic term, because he not only was a fabulous artist, but he was willing to break boundaries when a lot of people weren't. And I so appreciated the fact that he would put himself out there like he did. Was unique, and it was extraordinary, because people can put themselves out there, but if you don't have anything to back it up, it sort of becomes like an empty suit. But David Bowie always had something to back it up when he put himself out there, and I appreciated that. And as a side comment about that, I also totally agree with you in the fact that I think that not only Hollywood, but entertainment on television in particular, has become just a complete circus, and a bad circus at that, because everybody is looking for the blood that's going to lead their story with, you know, whether it's walking down the red carpet or whether it's reporting on news about somebody getting shot. It only seems to be the bad news or the sleazy news that leads, and the good news, such as our space program and things like that, hardly ever gets mentioned. And so David Bowie really filled a lot of the gaps with not only musical, leading in the musical department, but also making us aware that extraterrestrial life does exist in a way that we can't really see yet, but we can imagine. So I just am thrilled to have been in the same era that David Bowie was, and in many ways his life paralleled the Love and Spoonfuls, and so we really feel like contemporaries. I'm sure I can speak for everybody in the band when I say that too. So anyway, that's my speech to begin. How are you guys doing?
After all that, you know, the shock, I think I'm fine. I mean, I'm still trying to take it all in, but it's nice to talk to somebody, you know, from the things, the songs that you guys did back then. I mean, it helps along, because I got to tell you, it brings me to a nice place. It just brings back good memories. You know?
Well, you know, one of the things we made as a mission statement was good time music. And we John actually wrote a song called Good Time Music that didn't make it onto any of our released albums for Buddha Kama Sutra, but it was on the What's Shaken album on Elektra Records. And we made a kind of agreement when the band started that we weren't going to go picking up pieces and you know, making records just to get ourselves on the cover of the Rolling Stone magazine. We made music to provide good times for people. And when we do shows today now, 50, 51 years later, the comment I hear most frequently after the show when I get to meet the folks that came was, you know, you cannot imagine how much impact your, or they might say, do you believe in magic, or Summer in the City, or you didn't have to be so nice. You can't imagine how much impact that song had on me when I was 18 years old, or somebody that had their first date, or the proposed marriage, or any of these things, or that survived a foxhole in Vietnam because What a Day for a Daydream was firmly in their head. So the good time music was what the Love and Spoonful wanted to create, and we didn't want to create it on the backs of sensationalism or, you know, slimy behavior or stuff like that. And so that about the Spoonful's history I am most proud of.
Well, and now exactly, you've become a unicorn. You know, May and I talk a lot, Steve, about how that period of time in music, it's an anomaly now. I don't think it'll ever be repeated again. There was an innocence about it, and that we've lost so much innocence now. And part of it is because we're all accessible. There isn't anybody that isn't accessible. Unless you live in a hole somewhere under a mountain off the grid, everyone and everything is accessible. There's no mystery. There's no anticipation. So that time in music, it is a special time. And May, you know, people so often just think of her as, oh, well, she was, you know, John Lennon's girlfriend or whatever. But she's worked in the music business from the times when she was down dealing with writers and new artists. And you guys were all around, and there was such a camaraderie. It was different. Different. Is it because we're getting old, guys? Is that what it is? I don't know.
I got to tell you, I think from sorry, Steve. I was just – go ahead. If you want to say it, go ahead.
Well, what I was just going to add to that is that there was a special spirit about the 60s. And, you know, I grew up in the 1950s. When I say grew up, I was in school in the 1950s. I graduated in 1961. And, yeah, Happy Days was kind of the theme of it. But we were also ducking under our desks about hydrogen bombs and all this kind of stuff that made everybody on edge, not knowing if there was a future. And then, you know, once Kennedy got in office, and like a brief period that he was in, if he did nothing else for the generation that I grew up in, he provided us with inspiration for the future. And that inspiration translated into the songs that we wrote. Unfortunately, he wasn't around to appreciate what he really has, because I think I could speak for the entire generation of people that grew up under the influence of Kennedy's presidency. And it was such a positive thing. Yeah, I know behind the scenes there was a lot of stuff that went on, like in any presidency, but John Kennedy provided a generation with an inspiration to do good things and to make yourselves known in a positive way. And I think that's why that era is remembered as a golden era of pop music. And one side note, today's music, and I love it, don't get me wrong, I'm not down on today's music. There's some fabulous music out there, but they've run out of melodies. We used them all up. There's only so many melodies you can create out of a 12-note scale. And if you're a mathematician and know about permutations, we've probably gone way past the number of permutations for the 12-note scale. So I think there's a lot of inhibition about, oh, I've heard that before, oh, I've heard that before, so people don't write songs with melodies anymore. And that's too bad, because one of the things about 60s-era music is you remember the melody. Even if you can't remember the lyrics, you can hum the melody. And that's an important part about pop music, I think.
I know.
That's
true.
Spot on. You're absolutely right. Or as I should say, that's sleek. Because my daughter informed me that's the new word for, you know, on point. Okay.
Oh, well, I'm glad.
You are so right. And, I mean, May, you yourself would see people come in, songwriters, they'd come in with material, and they were always so generous with other musicians and other writers. There wasn't this, you know, kill or be killed attitude, or was there?
Right.
It just wasn't recognized.
No, it definitely, I mean, it was a different time, and, you know, songs, I think the songs, when you see the Carole Kings of the world, or, you know, any of the you know, the Brill Building writers, and you know, like John Sebastian wrote his, we could relate to it, and the Beatles, and, you know, it's songs that we could relate to. I cannot relate, and maybe it sounds old, but I see the trend. I see also is that that a lot of the young people are now going back to songs. You know, you look at commercials; they're going back to songs that could relate to us. I don't know. I don't know if we're going to be singing some of these hip hop songs in later time, and I can't hum it. And that's one of those things, you know. It's like American Bandstand when Dick Clark used to say, "Rate the record," you know. Can you hum it?
Mm-hmm.
Can you?
Yeah.
I can't remember. And that's the thing. And I wanted to be able to relate. So when you hear somebody singing "Up on the Roof," you hear those lyrics and you know what I'm saying, you know. Or "You've Got a Friend," you know, things that you can actually relate to.
Absolutely.
I think that the relating to is also about relating not on a harsh level, you know, and like when you hear some of these real, I'm talking about the real heavy duty hip hop songs. I don't want to hear that.
Yeah.
And when we did have a problem, we didn't have it so that it's so heavy that we can't relate to it, or it just sounds nasty. And I don't like, you know. And I think, you know, call me old fashioned, but that's how I look at songs and from day one. And always been.
Well, you know, and the first song that John and I wrote together was called "You Didn't Have to Be So Nice."
Yeah.
I would have liked you anyway.
And
that was a phrase that was a phrase that I came up with on a real life situation. And I think that's one of the missing elements. We wrote songs about real life situations, things that you could, what a day for a daydream. You're sitting there on a tour bus looking out the window and the only thing you got to do is a daydream. And so one of the things that Spoonful did, and certainly not just us, but almost all the writers of that era, is they took real-world situations and turned them into songs. And by real-world, and I don't mean Pollyanna in a way that they were all just happy-go-lucky, no-worry songs. You know, you listen to a song like "It's Not Time Now," one of John's, actually it's my favorite song by John Sebastian, and that's not a happy, that's a song about mistrust and
right.
Unfortunate circumstances in a relationship. But, you know, the idea that you can write a song about having a daydream that inspires you, or the meeting somebody that was so nice that they didn't even have to be that nice and you would have liked them anyway. And
right.
So I think that one of the things that we tried to do, and I said that earlier, was to keep things on the positive side of the scale. You know, there's enough negativity to go around without having to write more about it. And that is, and I agree with you, about the hip-hop and rap music, and to a large degree other forms of music, the grunge music of the 90s, there was a lot of negativity, and you could tell by the vocals. The vocals were not spoken or not sung with any kind of warmth. They were almost shouted and yelled.
Yes.
It's like as though... And, you know, another thing, and this is a slightly controversial side of the equation, in the 1960s, starting in about the early 60s, 61, 62, marijuana became introduced into the white music circle, people who were creating music in their early 20s. And beer and pot made a good mixture for writing nice songs. But as the drugs of choice became harder into the late 60s and early 70s, there's cocaine and then the harder opiate drugs and things like methamphetamine became popular, the tone of the music became harder. And you can almost look at it on a timeline, and you can see how music progressed from very easygoing. I never thought that I'd be 60, almost 60 years later, and marijuana is still not legal. It's almost like a joke. Thank God some of the states in this country have realized that it's a joke and stopped putting people in jail for using it. But I think if you look at the timeline, you can see how hard drugs influenced pop music, and I think that's one of the influences of the hip-hop and rap era, was that there was a lot of hard drug use and heavy drinking alcohol.
That's
so,
an interesting analogy.
Absolutely.
Yeah,
absolutely.
That, I never thought about it that way, but I think there's a lot of truth in that, you know.
There is.
The anger quotient across the board, whether it's in music, whether it's in movies, whether it's on television, it's just too much. And I agree with you. We don't want to go zippity-doo-dying through life, but can we not choose to face something that uplifts us instead of drags us down continuously? It's a lot easier to function from a higher plane when you feel good in spite of the fact that everything's falling apart around you. You say, that's okay, that's just today, you know. Do you believe in magic? You know, I mean, let's talk a little bit about you living on a boat, Steve.
Well, you know, it was very interesting, the scenario. I'm a lifelong sailor. I grew up in St. Augustine, Florida, and where I learned how to sail very young, and I was a champion in the small boat sailboat division, racing sailboats. And so I always had sailing in my blood. And during the 60s, as the band had its success, I had a dream that someday, one of my heroes as a kid was Carlton Mitchell. He was a yachtsman and a writer in Yachting Magazine, and he would write these stories from living on his sailboat in the Caribbean, and I was always fascinated by it. So as the decade moved on and the Spoonful ceased touring, I produced a band for Mercury Records called the Ox Pedals, and the man who got me the deal was Matt Weiss, and he was the American representative for the Beatles,
right.
Emperor artist.
Yes.
And
yes.
He made that deal with Mercury Records for me, and then when I completed that production, you know, a lot of negativity surrounded the Love and Spoonful that we can go into further on or not, but there was some negativity regarding the drug bust, and the negative aspect of it and the pressures of show business had gotten me to the point where once I had produced that album for Mercury Records, I wanted to just get away for a few years. So I went into Nat's office, and he had some employees of his that worked for the Beatles had brought by a copy of an album by this new artist named James Taylor on Apple Records, and that was in the summer of 68. So I knew James Taylor was going to be a monster star. I had heard that album, and I said, this guy is destined for fabulous success. And that, when I told Nat that I was leaving, I was going to go sailing, he said, well, listen, have you ever heard of this guy? And he pushed James's album across the desk to me, and I said, of course I've heard of him. You know, Arma and Jock brought the album out to me. And he said, well, would you be?
Had to be. Yeah.
Yeah. Well, you know them, of course.
I know them.
And so anyway, Nat said, would you be at all interested in producing James Taylor if he would be interested in having you do it? And I said, Nat, that is one incredible offer, and I appreciate it deeply, and I would love to work with James Taylor because I know he's going to be a fabulous star. But my head right now is so cooked on show business and the pressures that have been surrounding me for the last 2 years that I'm going to turn down the offer, and I'm going sailing. And then 2 months later, I literally had a yard sale out in West Hampton where I lived and sold everything I owned that wouldn't fit in 2 4x4x4 shipping crates. I'd already found a boat. I found a boat in the Virgin Islands. And, you know, I wrote a book called Hotter Than a Matchhead, Life on the Rum with the Love and Spoonful. It came out 2 years ago, and it's been very, very well received. And in that book, I tell the whole story of how I found my sailboat. It was a magical, it was believing in magic. Because when I subscribed to National Geographic magazine, and in February of 1968, there was an article in there about the Virgin Islands, and it showed a picture of Trunk Bay on St. John, and this sailboat was in that picture. And 2 years later, when I went down to the Virgin Islands to look at three sailboats, we couldn't find the two of the boats that we were going to look at, and the third boat we looked at and didn't like, but we took a water taxi over to St. John from St. Thomas, and we're going to spend our last day in the Virgin Islands before we went home at Trunk Bay, where that sailboat was in the picture in National Geographic 2 years before. And as we came around the curve, this is out of a movie, and Trunk Bay opened before us, right in the same spot that it was in the magazine article was this sailboat sitting there.
No.
And I said to Patty, my wife, I said, that looks like Cygnus. She said, well, you know it better than I do. And we got down to the beach, and I swam out to the boat. It was only about 100 yards offshore. I swam out to the boat, and I asked the skipper, I said, is this the Cygnus? He said, it certainly is. I said, is it still for sale? And he says, yes, it is. Come on board. And so I went back and got Patty. We came on board, and that's how we found my sailboat. It was just like a meant-to-happen thing because we thought we weren't going to be able to see Cygnus. It was supposedly had left the Virgin Islands to go down island. Mm. So anyway, I had a fabulous 3.5 years living on that sailboat. And it was just the timing was perfect because it was 1970 through 1973. And a lot of the guys coming back from Vietnam took their mustering out money and had bought sailboats. So there was a great community of people about my age, a lot of surfer guys. You know, there was a whole lot of industry going on. It was just the beginning of what became a fabulous source of income for a lot of guys my era and age. And it was just a great time. But in 1973, I knew that if I didn't go back and get started again in the music business, I may never get back to it. And I had completely flushed out my brain of all the negativity that had surrounded me. And I was ready and recharged and ready to go back. I'd also written about a dozen songs while I was down there. So, yeah, in 1973, I moved back to the States and just consider it one of the best times of my life. And mostly, I did it when I was early enough to appreciate it. I met so many people that waited until they retired or they were in their 60s or 70s. And they, you know, sailing's not something that you just go out and do like it's a drift along with the moon shining down on you. Sailing can be as tough as anything you've ever done out on the open ocean. So a lot of people put it off till they're physically unable to perform. And it was just a shame because I got to appreciate it, and you know, in 1973, the Caribbean was not yet discovered by what they call bare boats, which is where anybody could just rent a boat and go sail off, and all the harbors were empty. I found places that were no boats in sight. We were the only boat there for miles around. It was great. I wouldn't have traded those 3.5 years. And it was at the peak of my career. I probably could have done much, much better financially had I stuck around, say, for example, producing James Taylor. But it was important for me because if I didn't do that, there's no telling what might have happened. So
you literally had to check out so you could check back in, which is really what the whole point of it is that you're still in the game. And you know what? I think we need to have you back on again, Steve, because I think we just touched the tip of the iceberg of what your journey is. But we're running out of time, and I don't want to cut you off. I want to know, where are you guys still appearing? Are you touring? Where are you?
Oh, yeah, absolutely. We're going. We have two shows in Florida in the beginning week of February. Then we go out for back-to-back cruises on the Freedom of the Seas. It's a fabulous rock in the Caribbean cruise. Is one of the, we've done it several times before, and then the promoter that puts it on, Rocky, is just a fabulous event. It's all sold out, so that anybody that wants to get on this one would have to wait till next year.
Wow.
But, you know, we have probably going to be having maybe 25 dates over the course of the year coming up, which is just about right about how many I want to be performing.
Awesome.
The audiences have been great, so I would love to come back on. There's tons of stuff we didn't touch about today that
we'll definitely have you back, but we're like a minute out from going off the air. So I'm mesmerized by your story. All right, so people can go to Steve Boone. They can look you up on Google you. They can get to find your book. We can check where the Love and Spoonful is going to be. And will you promise to come back?
I promise to come back, and it's steveboone.net. That's the pathway to my book.
Awesome.
You got it.
Awesome.
Okay.
Steve,
good
we
to gotta
speak
say
with goodbye, you. But it was wonderful to have you on. Thank you so much.
My total pleasure, and it was great hearing you guys, and I would look forward to getting back on the air with you.
Absolutely.
Awesome. Take care. Have
great.
A wonderful day.
Same to you. Thank you.
I could have listened
I
to him
tell
like
you.
For an
it's,
hour.
We've
got to have him back.
Yeah, I know.
Now
he's fabulous. Absolutely.
We're out of time,
anyway.
Sister girl.
We're out of time.
All right, well,
to the next
that's
one.
The famous May Pang, and I'm Cynthia Nielsen, and you've been listening to Dinner Specials on Blog Talk Radio. Thanks, everybody.